All right, let's bring Peter McCullough in. Peter, can you hear me?
I can, thank you.
All right, we see you, but if you're driving, I want you to be careful. Are you behind the wheel?
No, I'm in the back seat.
Okay, good. All right, so you're safe. Excellent. Well, it was great. I met you briefly when you were speaking at the Your Health Freedom Utah event. Our friend Kristen Chevrier helped coordinate earlier last year. And obviously, we've been talking about you. Your ears are probably burning all the time. People are talking about you everywhere, but mostly good things, I promise. But you were on a lot of events. A lot of people are wanting to interview you. And of course, I talked about the attacks you've received. They've talked about you on Joe Rogan. In fact, Supernaut, do you have that clip on Joe Rogan where they're talking about Peter McCullough? I think it was with Robert Malone. I think that would be a good place to start here today.
You know, Peter McCullough is the textbook example of hunting physicians, right? The guy is $150,000 in debt right now in the hole in trying to defend his medical license. This is one of the most highly published authors in the world. He's an exceptional researcher, you know, and apparently a pretty good podcaster too.
The guy has published more in his field than any other physician in history.
And Baylor's trying to take him out. And it's not only Baylor, it's some entity outside of Baylor that's come in and is financing the attacks on him.
So obviously they're aware of what you're doing and they don't like it. We love it. We appreciate it. And how are you feeling? Do you feel like you're being hunted?
No, it's unfortunate, but I've just been asked by so many stakeholders, starting with Peter Navarro in the White House, and then later on a Senate Majority Leader for the Department of Homeland Security and the Governmental Affairs Oversight Panel, Ron Johnson. I was just asked to help out the country. Patriotically, I was trying to help out the country. I was doing research on how to treat COVID-19 patients, to avoid hospitalization and death. We met success. We came forward with lots of innovations to America. And, you know, I was doing what I thought was honestly a good citizen work that a leading doctor would do for the country.
Yeah, and Dr. McCullough, this is something, you know, I've been in broadcast media. This is my 23rd year, and I've interviewed so many folks over that time, almost 1,500 people, many of them multiple times. And one of the things you just described is what I call the Boy Scout perspective, that you are sincere in wanting to do the right thing and help people. And you find out at a certain point, doing that steps on the toes of others that have interest, economic or otherwise, that are not on the same wavelength. And suddenly you think, wait, why should I be attacked for trying to do the right thing, trying to help people, trying to help my country? And it's kind of a wake-up call to go, my gosh, those crazy homeopaths like me that have been warning folks about the medical monopoly being dangerous, not because medicine exists, but because it's a monopoly and those controlling factors don't like competition of any kind, including of thought.
Well, I've always been an intellectual risk taker. I've always worked across cardiology and nephrology. Broad in terms of my interest in internal medicine. I was unafraid to attack and research a viral disease that was basically causing millions of hospitalizations, slaughtered 800,000 Americans, sadly. And I was going to put my best foot forward, and I still will. But it is certainly disheartening to see that there are those who really have ill intent. They want to harm any doctor who's going to try to help patients with innovative treatments or with a fair, balanced assessment on vaccine safety and efficacy or whatever the next public health response would be. Listen, science is about discourse, and no product is free of a discussion on risks and benefits. Every product has risks and benefits. And so I've been part of a small group, I would say myself and Scott Atlas and Jay Bhattacharya, Harvey Risch, Steve Smith, Kirk Mulholm, Paul Alexander. There's a small number of us, honestly, in the entire world right now that are giving a fair, balanced review of the data on the national media.
Well, the fact that you're attacked for doing so, you know, for me to point out this over the years I've been broadcasting, you know, sometimes they relegate, they say, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. It's like, no, there's no theory about watching people attack. We've seen it done to Andrew Wakefield in his time for observing something that kind of stepped on the toes of interest, for instance, with MMR vaccines and other things. You've worked in the field of vaccinology for so long. I see many physicians such as yourself now looking backwards. You know, I know you're dealing with mRNA advancements in technology, but looking back at what we call traditional vaccinology and saying, maybe there were things that we got wrong about that, that those voices that were relegated to extremism or something maybe had some points to bring out about how the immune system works, that maybe it's not just about the holy grail of antibody development. Maybe it's much more complex than that. We should look at other ways to address immune challenges.
Yeah, I've always accepted vaccines in my practice. I thought they were part of conventional medicine, and I still do. But I think what you're talking about is vaccine hubris, or the lead up, what happened over years, the hubris that one, in a sense, shouldn't question vaccines as a preventive health measure, that somehow got built into the narrative, that there is no questioning. And so now when we have brand new agents that are gene check technology transfer products in the United States, they are, and elsewhere, the Sinovac is a killed vaccine. But the bottom line is, we have brand new technology, and this is absolutely the lifeblood of medicine, to have a fair, balanced discussion on this. When a lawsuit was announced against me last summer, I was called on national TV because the newspaper said that I was a skeptic. And I responded that skepticism is the lifeblood of science. Of course I'm a skeptic. Everyone should be a skeptic. Scientists should be skeptical. In fact, a criteria for a patent is skepticism. One would get a patent for a product if others were skeptical of it, because that's what's considered a component of objective indicia. So it's important to understand that teaching away objective indicia, these are fundamental concepts in science that make something novel and innovative. The vaccines have risks and benefits. America needs a fair discussion.
Isn't that interesting that the use of the term skeptic has now been denigrated to a word that is denigrating the person who's skeptical, right, within science? As to your point, that was the basis of good science, is always having a skeptical eye on things that you're told or observing and reviewing, etc. And now it becomes a badge of not honor, but a badge of, my gosh, we should relegate you to, nobody should listen to Peter McCullough because he's skeptical.
Well, there's no limit to the demagoguery. We've actually had a division head at the NIH, which is not a high position, a division head claim that he represents science. They claim they represent science. Well, I tell you, science is a process. It's a field of study. It's ever-changing. And all of us humbly serve and work in the field of science, and we utilize the principles of the scientific method. But no person can assume that they represent an entire field of study. Americans should listen to that degree of demagoguery and be alarmed.
You know, there's so much I want to talk with you about. I have no idea how much time we have today, but I'm grateful that you flexed with us to do this third hour of the Robert Scott Bell Show for whatever time you have. And I know it looks like you're going through a tunnel right now. Hopefully everything's okay.
I just came in a parking garage. I'll get out in a second.
No worries. Yes.
These nice fellows, they're drinking bro collaborators. But I can tell you, I'm not a drinking bro myself. I don't drink any alcohol, but they were actually quite cordial with me and allowed me to do this. So let me get out of the car as soon as I can get out. I think he has the child locks on.
Yeah, no escape from the car. But yeah, shout out to the drinking bros for caring for you and their team.
The drinking bros were good guys. They uttered a few expletives on the air. And I tell you, I'm really careful. I try to be like a Philip Rivers in the NFL. I try not to cuss at all. And I try to do the best I can. I don't drink at all, and I don't cuss. But the bottom line is, I had a great discussion. We went an hour and a half, and I think all the podcasters here in Austin, you know, they really idolize Joe Rogan.
Yeah.
And I went 15 rounds with Rogan in the man cave, and I can tell you, first rate. He's a good guy. He's intelligent, he's perceptive, and he integrates a lot of information fast. And one of the things that people told me is that Rogan spent a lot less time talking when I was on, and he spent a lot more time listening. And I think that basically should tell America that there is an important narrative for an independent scientist like myself, a practicing doctor who, you know, I've seen and examined hundreds and hundreds of COVID patients. You know, I have an opinion to be relayed to America about early treatment and about what we've learned with the vaccines, that it's important to talk to doctors in practice, mm-hmm, who are gaining experience with this new virus.
We had a Dr. Brian Artis on just the other day. I know you know him well. And we were talking about that, you know, the ability to take care of people as a homeopath. Of course, I use different methods and substances and medicines, if you will. But our goal is the same, to address what's really happening in the patient rather than saying they cannot have any treatment at all and we must just relegate them to an experimental injection, whether it be of the mRNA variety or otherwise. And you know, we've seen that those that are getting early treatment, whether it be allopathic, homeopathic, naturopathic, or any combination, are succeeding extraordinarily well, whereas those that are denied treatment or are just ended end-stage scenarios, put on a vent, et cetera, or remdesivir, which is so destructive to the liver and kidneys, is really iatrogenically causing death needlessly.
Right. So I want to respond to that. What does that tell you? That naturopathic approaches appear to be salutary. Allopathic approaches, osteopathic approaches. What does that tell you? That tells you that we have a crisis of compassion. What's leading people to have bad outcomes in COVID-19 is the complete and total abandonment of the physician-patient relationship or the caregiver-patient relationship. That's what's going on here. I bet if we had a randomized trial of just giving patients a phone call, it would reduce hospitalization and death. Can you imagine these poor seniors are given a fatal diagnosis, they're told to go home and wait alone in fear and suffering until they can't breathe anymore, and then come in the hospital. And then they come in the hospital, they can't see their loved ones again, and they know that's going to happen. And that's happened to 800,000 people have died, and it's happened to tens of millions of Americans who've been hospitalized. Can you imagine that that's the program? And that's been the program for 2 years now? I mean, this is extraordinary. This is a crisis of compassion. So does applying nutraceuticals and supplements work? Yes, because the virus is a prolonged illness. The cascade of inflammatory factors, the catalysts, that these play a role. Do traditional medicines that we use, antivirals, anti-inflammatories, immunomodulators, and anticoagulants, they have a role? Yes, they do. Because the same principles that we use in the hospital, we can advance early into the outpatient phase. Do other things work? For my radio show this week, I interviewed a nurse. Principles of nursing work, just providing compassionate care to patients? The answer is yes. So the point is, this is a crisis of compassion. The only people who are being harmed by this virus are those who are abandoned by others. It's an abject failure of the caring of caregivers to patients. The fiduciary relationship, the circle of compassion has been broken.
Peter, you're talking about vitamin L, love. That's huge. And it's exactly where we're at in terms of what's happened in the machinery of modern medicine, where it lost the spirit and mind part of it. It's all about body, maybe a little bit of mind. And we need to bring that back in. And I think we all, whether allopath, homeopath, naturopath, can work together because we've got the same goals in mind. The problem is we're not allowed to talk to one another, or if we do, or if we even adopt something that's a little off of what they say, oh, you're a sellout, right? And I think, again, that comes back to human communication, human compassion, all of these things that are lacking in what they call a healthcare system in America. I've called it a disease creation and management system because it's so impersonal and dehumanizing.
You know, I completely agree with that. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because we have not had a discussion, a national referendum on the issue of care of the COVID-19 patient. Where is the clinic or the healthcare system that considers themselves a center of excellence for COVID? None. Where's the independent innovative protocols by Harvard, by Mayo Clinic, Emory, University of Michigan, Northwestern? None. Zero. You go into any city in America. Right now I'm in Austin. I just came to a beautiful studio here for the next interview. Where's the billboard that claims, where a hospital claims to be a center of excellence for COVID? Who's competing for these patients? Hmm. You know, they are richly reimbursed by federal sources and no one seems to care.
Isn't that interesting? And you mentioned my alma mater, Emory University. I learned after graduating that they taught homeopathic medicine on the curriculum in medical school up until 1949. We go back to the history of medicine in America and we realize in 1910 there was a significant corruption of education through the Flexner Report, and it set the stage for a kind of a unifying education and economic support for only petrochemical patented medicines. that corrupted even those that are going into medicine for the right reasons, which I think most are, but they were no longer allowed to look outside. They were put on what I call pharmaceutical horse blinders, so we couldn't embrace the totality, I shall say, of many methods that can bring about healing in the patient's suffering.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think this is a big part of this. A recent paper by Fillmore and colleagues from the VA showed large number of individuals, 45% of veterans admitted to the hospital for COVID never had an oxygen saturation below 94%. What does that tell you? They're hospitalized out of panic. They're hospitalized out of excessive concern. They may have come with other disorders, and then they get tested for COVID, and it overlays another diagnosis, another set of anxieties. Mm-hmm. This is a crisis. It's an anxiety crisis. It is a medical global failure to not address the holistic aspect of what patients read right now. This is the medical disaster of our lifetime. My heart breaks. My phone is loaded with panic calls every day because patients say, I've lost trust in my doctors. My doctors won't answer me back. I'm having trouble breathing. I'm coughing. I feel sick. I'm scared. I think I'm going to die. They just want to talk to somebody.
Yeah, well, the as I said, the human element in medicine that was lost when, I believe, the allopathic physician community abandoned the spirit. Right? That godly aspect of the healer, the sacred relationship of the doctor-patient relay, it was all about communication, communing, and that was lost in pharmaceutical medicine exclusively to the human element, where we look at people as machines rather than spiritual beings here having human experiences. And I greatly appreciate your compassion and the energy you bring. Now, there are a lot of controversial areas of discussion. There's not just one, there's many. And I know you've been confronted by it on many of your talks and the events you've attended, including questions of viral causation versus, you know, the germ theory versus terrain, right? Is it the cause or is it the result of a corrupted terrain due to toxicity, deficiency? But even things you bring up like fear and anxiety, we know are powerful immunosuppressants, so that whether there is a virus present or not, the controversy therein, it almost becomes a secondary issue to what is the general health of the patient? What do they need? What do we need to get rid of?
Well, out of all illnesses, we know that SARS-CoV-2 infection or COVID-19, the illness, is amenable to risk stratification. What does that mean? That there's a tremendous spectrum of a risk by age, by other medical problems, comorbidities, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, that COVID-19 can be a nightmare for someone my age who is loaded with obesity, diabetes, and all these other factors, or it can be a breeze. And so we know risk factor modification really matters. I think basically health, both mental and physical wellness, matter, because this illness is not just a physical issue. It means psychological survival of a quarantine period, psychological survival of self-management, because people aren't going to be there to help you, and then psychological survival, heaven forbid if it happens, of hospitalization and isolation. That means where virtually no one sees you in the hospital. You lay there hour by hour by yourself alone. Listen, I just have a time for one more question on your show and we'll wrap it up.
You got it, Peter. And I'm so appreciative of your flexing with me. And I hope that we can do this again when we're sat down, because we are drinking brothers too, but I drink yerba mate tea. Not alcohol either, but we have a good time with that. So my concern, of course, with the mRNA injections, Fauci is saying we're going to get those kids younger than five, and I'm going to be meeting with a PhD researcher who is pointing out some very serious considerations related to fertility, pregnancy, and children. Are you seeing any warning signs about that mRNA injection experimentally in younger and younger ages?
We're seeing huge warning signs. I'm a cardiologist. I'll take the one the FDA warns about. Myocarditis or heart inflammation, late-breaking study by Scharf and colleagues, Kaiser Permanente Northern Division. The rates of myocarditis, bombshell report, far higher than we ever thought. And the peak age is 18 to 24. It's actually college kids. College kids, they hit a number of boys over 400 cases per million shots. 400 cases per million shots. This is extraordinary. We know that the background rate of myocarditis in children is roughly 4 per million. And we know the rate of hospitalization and death for that age group for COVID-19, far less than 1 per million. So this is a very unfavorable trade-off. Can you imagine 400 per million? Do you know how many kids go off to college each year that age? 20 million. Yeah. So do 20 times 400. Think about the number of cases of heart injury that we're going to have in the United States as we cycle the kids through this. The CDC has already told us we've had 21,000 cases of heart injury, heart damage in young people with myocarditis with the messenger RNA vaccines, and we're just getting warmed up. These numbers suggest we're going to go far in excess of 100,000 injured young people.
Yeah.
And all for no reason.
And that's what I see. A lot of the COVID manifestation and COVID shot manifestation is endothelial attack on the vascular system and the heart. Yeah. So a lot of my strategy is about shoring that up and repairing it. And I'd love to talk with you more about that the next time you come on. I hope that you would come on again.
Well, now that I have your app downloaded and I have my IT act together, Robert, let's
you
go on
great.
Again. Molson, we'll get on it. We'll do a deep dive, and I'm looking forward to it. Great interview.
Yeah, and we have your links, AmericaOutloud.com, if you want to see Peter's own presentations that he does in his broadcasting. We also have truthforhealth.org, a foundation that you may want to support. And there's also a givesendgo.com link in the show notes to support Peter McCullough with his IT and travel costs and everything else. And Peter, big hugs. Tip of the hat, and also some tea for you, my friend. And good luck. Hold that voice together. Spray some silver hydrosol down there, and you'll be all right.
Okay, I will. Thanks a lot, Robert.
All right. That's Peter McCullough here on the first time he's ever been on the Robert Scott Bell Show. Enjoyed that. As you said, walking up and down the aisles and stairways, and what a champion. And I'd love to have him on again.